Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Thanks for joining us today in the podcast.
Yeah, welcome to our edition of Speaking of Reliability, everybody. And Fred and I have some topics we want to go through, and I think we know the first one because, Fred, you, when I mentioned it, you actually said you had just written something about it.
That's right, yeah. I got a question a couple of days ago about, well, I'm using, we have a temperature chamber, and I'm using it at above what we expect our product to be used at. How do I use the Arrhenius equation to get an acceleration factor? And it made me think, you know, it's like, was that the right question to ask? And I backed up quite a bit in my answer back to him. So that's what made me, you know, go, oh yeah, I know about this topic. If you're getting ready to do a test, of any kind of test, it doesn't start with, oh, I happen to have a chamber, let's use it. So...
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And for me, the interest was, you know, people wanting to use accelerated life testing or even other testing methods and saying, all right, let's do this. And not being aware, which is, comes from experience, that there's a lot of pieces you have to have in place beforehand. So, for example, if cycling temperature is what you believe is driving your primary wear out failure mode, do you know the temperatures that the components that wear out actually cycle through, right? Because it's not just the external temperature, it's the temperature of the component that, you know, and do you know which components you think we should focus on? And do you, have you done root cause analysis to confirm its fatigue and on and on and on. And, you know, having those, having done that work as prep, like anything, prep is key. The testing is much more effective and there can be a sense of disappointment of like, oh, you know, we can't get this going. And I end up writing a whole set of test sequences that aren't the XR life tests. They're the things we need to do to have the input information.
Well, before we dive into that, let's take a quick pause here for a message, and we'll be right back.
Kirk Gray here. We want you to know that my company, Accelerated Reliability Solutions, is ready to support you with experienced leadership, guidance, and training to rapidly develop reliable, robust, and mature electronics at market introduction. To get started, go to accendoreliability.com/go/accelerated.
Yeah, I, Adam, I think you were starting to ramp up there, and I'm getting that way too, because we should probably create a checklist. It, although I'm loath to do that because it every test I've done has been unique. Yet I believe there's some fundamentals to, you know, basic things you need to make sure you do when you set up any reliability test, an accelerated test even more so. I don't know, what are your, if somebody asks you, hey, I want to do an accelerated life test, how do I get started? What would be your, what would be your number one, two, three?
I think something along the lines of the checklist, like what you're saying, where effectively, I think on my side, I should just communicate much more clearly, hey, when we get this going, you know, do you have these pieces of information? Do you understand this? You know, these are the inputs we need. And if the answer is no, it's like, all right, these are the things we need to pursue in advance. So there's, for me, in my role, there is some fault in not being more explicit about that. And that, because I know I'm expecting to probably have to do some work in there, but have I really communicated to them? Or I'm assuming they've already done that and that they do know these things.
Well, let's be a little more clear. So let's say we're setting up an accelerated life test for a pen, a new fancy way to do ballpoint pen, right? Maybe it's for a pressurized vessel and it can write upside down or whatever, right? You're talking about stuff like, do they know where it's going to be used? What temperature is going to be used? What forces is it going to be used under? How long is it expected to last? It's what's the goal for it? Those are the kinds of details that I would expect to be available during the design of a product. And if they're not, we'd have to, like if we were looking at how hard can you press before it breaks, or we want to accelerate it by putting more pressure on it, well, what pressure does it have now? And how much margin is there before it fractures? We can't accelerate it unless we know where our starting point is. And then vice versa, as you get results, you got to translate them back to the use conditions. There again, yep. You need to know the use conditions.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep, those factors. So in a way, it is making, maybe what it is making a very specific phase of the program that does this, right? So, and not just, I don't mean the high level program, I mean the testing program.
Well, I think you need that information. You need that information whether you're doing testing or not.
Yes, you do, which is why I usually assume it's there, but it's not. Right.
It often isn't. Right. All right. So we get the use conditions, right? We find out how it's supposed to be used. I think another piece that many people miss is they go, oh, accelerated testing. That's just higher temperature, or maybe we just we cycle it a bunch. Well, years ago I learned that electronics, like 80% of the components and materials within an electronics circuit have failure mechanisms that are accelerated by temperature. There's a lot of chemistry going on. There's a lot of diffusion going on, corrosion, all those kinds of things. And temperature is an accelerant for it. And every one of those things behaves to a rise in temperature differently. So just throwing it in a chamber and hoping it accelerates everything in a meaningful way is folly. Vice versa, there's 20% of failure mechanisms that are really immune to just high temperature. They mm-hmm. don't care, right? And you need chlorines and other salts available for the corrosion to occur, the electromigration to occur. Different kinds of phenomena require different stresses. And if you don't include those stresses, you're not going to see them. So if I'm really, really interested in a hinge and how many times it can activate back and forth before it becomes too loose, I could put it in a high temperature chamber for years and I will not learn anything, right?
I got to
exercise it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And that's, of course, obvious to us because we all use hinges, but with some, very complex and unique, features and functionalities. Yeah, it's not obvious till you've done that investigation and really no root cause, right? Because you're basing the acceleration model on a specific root cause, wear out mm-hmm. failure mechanism. And yeah. If it's wrong, it's wrong. If you're using the Arrhenius model, but it's really cycling fatigue, you're wasting your time.
That's right. I think that would be my number one thing is you have to know the failure mechanism. The actual mm-hmm. mechanism, the chemistry or physics of what's actually leading to failure. And if you mm-hmm. have a model for it, it makes the testing a bit simpler. If you don't have a model for it, that's good to know also because you won't pick the wrong model off the shelf. You'll have to go create it, which is more complex, right. But you get better information, way better information. But if you just, I think I've mentioned this story before, Adam, is that I was sitting across the table from this mechanical engineer, and he's designing a portable inkjet printer. It's intended to be for the salesman and use it, pull it out of their briefcase at the hotel room and print, or in their car or stuff like that. And it's a little cute little printer that could print regular paper. And he was handing it to me and asking at the same time, so how long will this thing last? Mm-hmm. If I give you one, can you tell me how long it'll last? And we dropped it. Now I claim he dropped it and he claims I dropped it. So it's a we dropped it and it shattered, just went to pieces. And I said, it'll last about 3 feet.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's that electromechanical device is incredibly complex and had hundreds, if not thousands of ways it could fail. Being a portable system, it really is going to have to survive a drop test. And is that an accelerated test? Drop it from higher than you expect. Yeah, it accelerates it. It's more force. Mm-hmm. I think part of the what I'm leading up to here, Adam, is that you need to know what's important to test for.
Right. All right. So if that's it and we both agree, how do we initiate that? Basically we're suggesting, do we say, hey, start with a DFMEA, let's get everybody's brains together and come up with a list of things. And then the actions coming out of that will be pursuit of those? So yeah. To pretest the FMEA, a little brief one, or?
Well, no, I think the FMEA type work highlights what's where the unknowns are. Where, you know, we believe this is a risk, but we don't know. And answering an accelerated life test is a way to answer that question. The other is our early prototypes. How did they fail? What failure mechanisms are we actually seeing? And are they relevant to our use conditions? And do we need to worry about those things? Is it going to lead to catastrophic failures? Are the fixes and the improvements we're making actually going to work? Unknown vendors. I'm thinking of the list of the general red flags of uncertainty in a design. And FMEA and HALT testing. HALT is another way to find those failure mechanisms so that then you can design an accelerated test to answer a question. Is basically, once we know what's going to fail or what we suspect is going to fail, then we can answer the question or design a test to answer the question long before it fails. And that's the accelerated testing. So FMEA, HALT, engineering judgment, early prototypes, the actual failures we're seeing, the types of areas that we have the least margin, all of those things are indicators or clues of where we need to go look for failures. And then it's identify those failure mechanisms that we have the highest risk or the most uncertainty about, and then go to the lab and do the accelerated testing.
Right. Yeah. It's a pretty substantial program phase too, because we're talking about a lot of resource and time. So that's probably one of the biggest challenges is when you do highlight that, you know, these teams that expected to do this one phase actually really have, you know, at least doubled the work to do as far as scheduling and resource.
Well, yeah, there's that. And I'm loath to do, I've done hundreds and hundreds of accelerated tests over the years, yet it's the last resort in my opinion. Because it is expensive. It does take a lot of resources. And it should only be done when you have a question worth answering. Years ago, I was working on early package in our products called, and it was using a ball grid array. And so today, they're pretty common. Yet at the time, we were using these little gull wing leads, little wire leads coming out of the side of the electronics package. And this was the first one where they put all these little bumps underneath it. And so the old timers in the factory are like, well, I can't see those. How do I know it's any good? Right. So we used x-rays actually to take a look at it. And we cut them open and we did all kinds of things to evaluate it. Yet the team agreed that before we launch this new product, which would be making a million a month, let's make sure that those solder joints work and we know how to create them, how to actually assemble them correctly, because you can't touch them up. We really damage them when you repair them or replace them. So we got to get it right to start with. And so we need to know that we have it right and that they will last long enough for our application. And so it was decided pretty early in the program that this was a major risk for the program. And there was a dual design pattern all the way through until we had the answer for the accelerated life test that, yes, we can go with this package versus keep the old one. Then the new package offered a lot of new functionality, capability, and size reduction for the product. So it had very real feature sets that the team wanted to incorporate, but they had plan B in case it didn't work. And so I was in charge of doing the accelerated life test. And I think I spent $50,000 on monitoring that we already had the chambers available. I probably spent another $50,000 just on test boards and then making sure they worked and making sure, you know, and I spent a month just setting up to start the test and making sure that the measurements were accurate, that I could make measurements, that I could detect failures, that the chamber was actually changing temperature as we expected it and as fast as we expected. And I got into, you know, relaying out the airflow in the chambers because there were obviously hot spots and cold spots. And so the products at the top of the chamber were seeing a completely different profile than the ones on the bottom. And so we wanted to minimize that. You know, it was a lot of work just to get the test started. And then it was regular checking. How do I know the test is actually working?
And they aren't quick tests either, especially for items that run at high temperatures. You don't have a lot of margin to accelerate it with temperature without burning it, which you don't want to do.
It is a quick way to make them fail.
Exactly. It's just, I don't know how to translate that when you set fire to it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, for that failure mechanism, yes, it does fail pretty quickly, but it's not one we're interested in. So.
Right. That's what I call burning the onions when you're trying to caramelize them, right? I always have that cooking analogy I do.
Once you know what the failure mechanism, then it gets into measurement techniques and how do you check it and how do you get power to it? How do you get it? Everything in your test has got to be more robust than your product. So the wiring and connectors and sensors and everything else has got to be more robust, which can be difficult to do. So it's, there's a lot to it. And it's fun. And there's plenty of ways to do accelerated testing that don't involve chambers. And yet it does take some creativity to isolate the failure mechanisms you're interested in and to know that you're actually exercising that part of your system in a meaningful way. One of the articles I wrote just recently was about success testing. You know, setting up a design and running the equivalent of a lifetime of your product's experience or stresses. And if they all pass, then you can claim some minimum reliability with some confidence.
So like a binomial type.
Right.
Type testing demonstration.
That's right. A demonstration test where you're planning on not having failures. And and it minimizes the number of samples you need for that style of test. But there is a way to get even fewer samples, right? And that's if you can measure something that degrades over time. So it switches it from being a pass-fail at the end of the experience of the stress to it goes a little slower as it ages, or like a hinge, right? On a device that's supposed to hold a sensor at a particular, it's on an articulated arm and it's supposed to hold it steady, right? Yep. So as those hinges wear and become a little bit looser, they don't hold it as steady. They have less ability to hold still and they drift, right? Which would be a failure, but you can measure the resistance to motion wherever it is. And so by measuring the loss of that resistance over time, you're measuring a degradation. Now I don't need as many samples because I can get them, I can track them all to failure. Whereas if I have to go just a pass fail test, then I need more samples. It goes back to that, what do they call it? Oh, I've drawn a complete blank on the type of data. I want to say analog data, but it's not it.
Well, the thing is, there's always a trade-off because you're saying it's less samples, but actually it's more, but just you didn't have to do it because that's you do the degradation model when you have the luxury of a database and projection curves that were previously created, right?
Well, if you have that, no, but even if you don't have it, you can, if I start 20 samples and I can monitor the degradation at different stress levels, I can map them all out to failure. Right? They're going to create some pattern or path to failure. And all of them fail. So I get perfect data, nothing's censored. Whereas if I start 20 samples and it's a pass-fail, I run them through the exercise, what I think is their range of motion, for example, and I can only claim a much lower threshold for reliability I demonstrated because I have no failures.
Wait a second. How do you run something and not run it to failure and do a projection curve on its behavior? So if it was noise, let's say in a bearing or something, and noise is not the failure mechanism, it's something else. It's
a precursor, whatever. An indicator of auto roundness.
So how would you have that correlation and project it out without having experienced a failure?
Measure it to start, right? Here's my baseline. Mm-hmm. Here's where it starts. Measure it the next day, measure it the next week, measure it the next week, and so on. And as that amount of noise increases, that's what I'm plotting, is the repeated measures of that indicator, that measurement. And as it increases, I say, hey, when it gets to 30 decibels, I'm going to call it a failure, or it gets to the certain frequency or threshold, whatever I define it as, is I'm going to call that a failure. And so the assumption we're making, and it's best if you can run them all the way out to some failure, but just do repeated measures and plot the change versus time for that unit. I'm drawing here in the air, so I'm sure that's helpful.
No, I know, but it would take a lot of confidence to do that. I would want to pull on something historical because things aren't linear.
Oh yeah, it's always better to run to failure. But if it's going to take you two years to do it, you just don't have the time. So, one of my first decelerated tests is that kind of behavior, is that we knew it was an oxidation process and it changed the resistivity of this material that we were working with. And so we measured resistivity over time. And it had this phenomena where when you first put it in the chambers and heated it up, it would get actually become a better performing product. A lot of products do that. They break in or they show this change that goes to the benefit of the product. And then it just started to degrade. And the old testing style was that we would take 3-4 points along that curve and draw a straight line through it and say, that projects off to failure. Nobody prior to me was interested in letting them run. And so I found a whole pile of tests that were started a year, 2 years, and 3 years prior that were still in the chambers. Nobody had taken them apart yet. So I said, yeah, I'm not going to just throw these away. Let me measure these. And I let them run and continue to make measurements on it. And I found out that they didn't follow that straight line. It did curve. So instead of 2-3 points the first couple of months of this, what looked like a straight line, is that line flattened out. The resistivity did not continue to degrade precipitously or on a straight line. It flattened out. And at that point, and this is probably a different topic, is what do you do when you learn something in an accelerated test? In that case, I went to a chemist and said, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And we found out that the outer layer of the material inhibited the transmission of oxygen into the inner layer. So it reduced the ability for it to oxidize at the inner layers. And so it was like a protective coating was being, there's some materials, metals that do that, right? They create
aluminum does, right?
Yeah. They create an oxide layer that then prevents more oxidation from occurring.
Well, it's actually a ceramic. Oxidized aluminum is, I think, technically a ceramic, right? So it makes a ceramic coating on itself.
That's right. And so our little product did that unbeknownst to anybody in the group. And so we started tracking that curve, and overnight, our products became much more reliable and more consistent with what our technicians were telling us in the field.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Well, I'm sure we definitely highlighted that there's more discussion and prep work that has to happen to ensure, the team's not surprised with us being involved, but great. All right. Well, we covered some good stuff. Well, I'm glad we got to chat about that. I have a feeling we'll probably talk more about that again.
We probably sparked more questions than answers, so.
Yeah, well, that's what we're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
So to our listeners, please go to reliability.fm and, you will find a great resource of other podcasts and articles and all kinds of things and opportunities to reach out to us and ask questions as well. So it's a great episode. All right, thank you, Fred.
All right, thanks, Adam.
All right, take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.